Wyoming's and Utah's positions were not materially different than the position of Colorado and New Mexico. And yet, if Bridge Canyon Dam were not built, with its promise of huge amounts of high-priced peaking power, how could the rescue project they insisted on be self-financing? It couldn't. But no reclamation project had ever been built that didn't at least create the illusion that it was self-financing. For the moment, however, the Upper Basin states were not worried about that. They were much more worried about a former magazine editor and amateur lepidopterist from Berkeley, California, named David Brower. David Brower's passionate opposition to dams has its origins in his teeth. Brower's childhood, spent in that most tolerant of American cities, had not been happy. He had an awkward case of shyness, and to boot, a row of missing teeth, and his schoolmates taunted him mercilessly about both. In his mid-teens, he departed for the only place in California where he felt he would be left alone, or at least find better company, the Sierra Nevada. In those days, the late 1920s, backpacking and mountaineering were considered the oddest of preoccupations, the province of slightly deranged British peers. The Sierra Nevada, which is invaded by so many hikers today that it feels like a zoo, was virtually devoid of humanity. The rapture Brower experienced there transported him to a mystic state. It became a dependency, a drug. He had food and supplies cached all over the place. He could return to one weeks after laying it in, and it would still be there. Like his hero John Muir, Brower grew intimate with vast portions of that range. He would return to Berkeley, work at odd jobs for a while, make enough money to quit, and leave for the mountains again. By his late 20s, Brower had become the sort of person the water development lobby cannot fathom, someone who puts unspoiled nature above the material aspirations of mankind. For his part, by the time he became the first paid executive director of the Sierra Club in 1952, Brower had decided that no work of man violated nature as completely, as irrevocably, as a dam. Relatively late in life, Brower had discovered the sublime emptiness of the plateau and Red Canyon country of the Colorado River Basin. It was the same terrain that had enchanted John Wesley Powell 80 years before, and it was almost as unpeopled and unspoiled as it had been then. Brower loved everything about it, the bottomless dry wind-sculpted canyons beginning suddenly and leading nowhere, the rainbow arches, overhangs, and huge stately monoliths. An expert rock climber, Brower had pioneered the route up the most impressive of them, Shiprock in New Mexico. The amphitheater basins ringed by great hanging rock walls, the chiaroscuro desert sky with its promise of rain that rarely came. Above all, he loved the desert rivers. Brower's favorite place in the Colorado Basin was Echo Park. Near the confluence of the Green and the Yampa rivers, Echo Park was a pure indulgence in the most austere of deserts. In autumn, its groves of cottonwood and yellowing willow gave it a New England air. In the spring, the swollen green would flood the canyon bottom and leave lush meadows as it went. Echo Park was probably the most beautiful canyon flat in all of Utah, part of Dinosaur National Monument. It was also an ideal site for a dam. Echo Park Dam was to have been a part of the Colorado River Storage Project, one of the first of the giant cash register dams. David Brower loathed it as he had never loathed something before. Brower had no training as an engineer, but he was the son of an engineer, and he led the fight against Echo Park Dam in the late 1950s, going after the Bureau with its own favorite weapon, statistics. Brower liked to quote Disraeli about the three kinds of lies: lies, dam lies, and statistics. The Bureau had confidently proclaimed that Echo Park would conserve 165,000 acre-feet of water over any alternative site. Brower demonstrated convincingly that it would conserve 19,000 acre-feet at most. The Bureau said it would add to the basin's water supply. Brower argued, with evaporation figures, that the basin might well lose water if Glen Canyon, the other big cash register dam, was also built. He demonstrated that a coal-fired power plant would produce power for less money. It would be a great mistake, he told an incredulous congressional subcommittee composed mainly of Westerners, to rely on the Bureau's figures when they cannot add, subtract, multiply, and divide. The Bureau reacted to such challenges with a mixture of bafflement and contempt, especially after Brower admitted that he had only made it through the ninth grade. But he had been secretly coached by Walter Huber, then the president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. For someone who had limited skill with people, Brower had an amazing ability to marshal expertise, and his calculations were largely supported by General Ulysses S. Grant of the Corps of Engineers. Sometime later, the Bureau's regional director in Salt Lake City, Ole Larson, was presented with a rubber slide rule by a group of fellow engineers. It was his award for stretching the truth at Echo Park. In the end, Brower and a handful of conservationists managed to bring about the biggest defeat the Western lobby had suffered until then, a denial of funds to build Echo Park Dam. To pull it off, though, they had had to compromise. For the sake of victory at Echo Park, they had agreed to leave Glen Canyon Dam alone. Later, when the dam was already under construction, Brower floated this then almost inaccessible reach of the Colorado River in a dory much like Major Powell's. He was astonished by the beauty of the place, as were most of a handful of people, a few thousand perhaps, who managed to see Glen Canyon before it was drowned. When the reservoir filled, Brower's friends actually wondered whether he might shoot himself. In the foreword to a Sierra Club book called The Place No One Knew, he flagellated himself over the loss. Glen Canyon died in 1963, he wrote, and I was partially responsible for its needless death. So were you. Neither you nor I, nor anyone else, knew it well enough to insist that at all costs it should endure. Never again, Brower vowed, was he going to compromise over such a dam. The battle over the Grand Canyon dams was the conservation movement's coming of age. Only the upper basin had wanted Echo Park built. The lower basin states had neither remained neutral or opposed it. But now everyone knew the river was overallocated, and everyone wanted to see it replenished by water from somewhere else, so all the basin states were in favor of the Grand Canyon dams. Never before had conservationists challenged the collective will of seven states. Brower and the Sierra Club led the fight. As in the Echo Park battle, he managed to recruit heavyweight expertise. Luna Leopold, one of the country's leading hydrologists and the son of Aldo Leopold, the famous ecologist, was willing to take a swipe at the Bureau's flows calculation. Brower found some nuclear engineers from MIT in Bechtel who were eager to demonstrate why nuclear reactors were a cheaper alternative. Brower would later become one of the leading opponents of nuclear fission. His most valuable discovery, however, was an utterly unknown 30-year-old mathematician from New Mexico named Jeffrey Ingram. Ingram was a self-described fanatic about two things, the Grand Canyon and numbers. He loved playing with figures, and above all, he loved exposing figures as frauds. In particular, pyramid schemes fascinated him, and in the Bureau's payback scheme for the Pacific Southwest Water Plan, he thought he had discovered the greatest pyramid scheme anyone ever saw. In order to finance the Cap and Bridge and Marble Gorge dams, Ingram discovered, the Bureau planned to capture the revenues from Hoover, Parker, and Davis dams after their power sales had paid them off in the late 1980s and reroute them into the new projects. For one thing, the Bureau, under reclamation law, had no business doing this. All surplus power revenues were supposed to revert to the Treasury in order to compensate the taxpayers for having forgiven interest obligations on the irrigation features of the projects. But that was not the half of it. The whole rationale for the Grand Canyon dams was that the river would have to be augmented someday, and power dams were the only means of raising money for an importation project. The new dams, however, would be terrifically expensive compared to their predecessors. Hoover had been built for the incredibly low sum of $50 million. Bridge Canyon would likely cost close to $1 billion. Because of their enormous cost, the new dams would see their revenues tied up for years, for decades, repaying their own costs and subsidizing the cap, a subsidy that was crucial if the Bureau was to find anyone to buy its water. Even if revenues from Hoover, Parker, and Davis dams were added, all of that money would be consumed for a seemingly endless period paying for the new works and the cap subsidy. It would be financing the depletion of the river. There would be no money for augmentation until long after the basin was predicted to run out of water. In fact, according to Ingram's calculations, if you didn't build the Grand Canyon dams, money would start flowing into the development fund sooner than if you did. Ultimately, the dams would generate a lot of money, perhaps enough to finance most of the cost of diverting a distant river, if one could be found. But by then it would be too late. The Colorado River would have long since run dry. It was a formidable argument, and it forced the Bureau of Reclamation to redirect its creative energies toward convincing the Bureau of the Budget that it wasn't really so. In the meantime, David Brower was free to do what he did best, publicity. With the help of two San Francisco advertising men, Jerry Mander and Howard Gossage, the Sierra Club took out full-page advertisements attacking the dams in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Los Angeles Times. One of the Bureau's arguments for building the dams, an argument which it would later regret, was that tourists would better appreciate the beauties of the Grand Canyon from motorboats. "Should we also flood the Sistine Chapel?" asked one advertisement, "so tourists can get nearer the ceiling?" The response was thunderous. Dan Dreyfus was still with the Bureau of Reclamation then, in charge of planning projects like the CAP. "I never saw anything like it," remembers Dreyfus. "Letters were arriving in dump trucks. 95% of them said we'd better keep our mitts off the Grand Canyon, and a lot of them quoted the Sierra Club ads." Jerry Mander and Howard Gossage were both geniuses, Broward would later reminisce. "We did a split run of one ad. I wrote one which went, 'Who can save Grand Canyon? An open letter to Stuart Udall.' Jerry Mander said, 'Now only you can save Grand Canyon from being flooded for profit.' We arranged to have a split run because I thought my ad was saying the right things and he thought his ad was. The upshot of it all was that Jerry Mander's ad outpulled mine 2-1. The Sistine Chapel line was suggested by a Sierra Club member from Princeton. I wasn't sure about it. Jerry Mander jumped at it. He was right. That ad was dynamite. It was the ad the Internal Revenue Service cited when they revoked our tax-deductible status." Who persuaded the IRS to revoke the Sierra Club's tax-deductible status is a question still debated today. Brower is convinced that Congressman Morris Udall, Stewart's brother, was behind it. He insists Udall even confessed to him once in an unguarded moment. Others suspect Stewart. Everyone wanted to lay the blame with Dominey, but private memoranda from Dominey's file suggested he was as perplexed as anyone else. He wanted to locate the culprit so he could congratulate him. It was obviously a purely political strike. Other tax-deductible groups were at least as active in trying to influence legislation as the Sierra Club, and nothing happened to them. Whoever was responsible, the Sierra Club suddenly found itself tilling fundraising soil as dry as the West's, and had a close brush with bankruptcy. Brower, for his part, would soon find himself without a job, fired by the club's board of directors for fiduciary responsibility. But in the end, none of it was to make much difference. The ads had been published. The public was outraged. The Grand Canyon dams were doomed to defeat. Everyone knew it except Floyd Dominey, the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Colorado Basin states. At the same time that Lyndon Johnson was telling himself, and anyone who would listen, that the opponents of his war in Vietnam were a handful of draft dodgers, the proponents of the Grand Canyon dams were telling themselves that their opposition was limited to the Sierra Club. The real problem, Wayne Aspinall, Carl Hayden, and Floyd Dominey would fume, was Dave Brower's lies. Once people understood that Bridge Canyon Dam would only flood Grand Canyon National Monument and not the park itself, they would come around and support the dams. They believed, in other words, that the fate of the dams hinged on a technicality. They couldn't fathom that a sea change in public feeling toward the natural world was taking place. One of those epical shifts that guarantee that things will never be the same. But it was, and people didn't care whether the dams flooded the monument or the park, or whether they drowned a mile or 100 miles of the canyon, or whether they submerged the bottom 50 feet or the entire chasm, they wanted no dams, period. In 1966, the National Reclamation Association held its annual meeting in Albuquerque, and Brower, to his considerable surprise, was invited to speak. To the NRA's surprise, he showed up. So did Wayne Aspinall, the chairman of the House Interior Committee, and when a photographer spied them 20 feet apart, he tried to arrange a picture. Aspinall glared at Brower and shouted, "No picture of mine is being taken with that liar." When a reporter asked the congressman how Brower had lied, he responded that the dams would in no way flood the national park. They would merely flood 120 miles of the Grand Canyon. As far as Aspinall was concerned, that was a distinction of the utmost significance. As for Dominey, facing the prospect of a major defeat for the first time in his life, he not only believed that Brower was a liar, he was convinced he wasn't worth worrying about. "If you even suggested to Dominey that Brower was winning," says a former bureau man, "he would have fired you on the spot." Finally, when even his allies in the Southwest began to have misgivings about Bridge Canyon Dam, Dominey began to take his nemesis a little more seriously. He ordered employees to stalk Brower, showing up at his speaking engagements to report on what he said and get in a little heckling on the side. But Dominey's men either were poor judges of audience response or were so afraid of their chief that they told him exactly what he wanted to hear. "Mr. Brower's talk was highly emotional," wrote a bureau man in a blue envelope report on a Brower address. "It was completely lacking in any kind of substantiating data, and he appeared a far less formidable opponent than anticipated. It is my opinion from this encounter that the Bureau should encourage face-to-face discussions with Mr. Brower before unbiased audiences, because any reclamationist, armed with basic facts, could adequately defend the Bureau's position against his pure emotionalism." In that particular speech, Brower had said that he wouldn't mind dams in the Grand Canyon as long as the Bureau built a comparable canyon somewhere else. He received a standing ovation in Denver. The handwriting was on the wall by March of 1966, when the Reader's Digest ran an article attacking Marble Gorge and Bridge Canyon dams in a tone that could almost be described as enraged. Right after the Reader's Digest article, Life ran a big goddamn diatribe, remembered Dan Dreyfus. "Then we got plastered by My Weekly Reader. You're in deep shit when you catch it from them. Mailbags were coming in by the hundreds, stuffed with letters from school kids. I kept trying to tell Dominey we were in trouble, but he didn't seem to give a damn. It was kind of surprising, because Dominey could be very flexible when it came to the smaller projects. He made some big concessions here and there and wasn't bothered by it. On this one, he was an utter maniac. In a way, you can't fault the man, though, because even though Dominey was a good liar when he had to be, here he was a prisoner of his own intellectual honesty. A lot of people figured that no one was going to let the Southwest run out of water, and if the time came when it wanted more, the country would just pay for it, whatever the cost. I mean, New York City was full of immigrants, criminals, minorities, so who gave a damn if it went bust? But Phoenix and irrigated farmland, that was America. So it may have been a correct assumption. But Dominey said, no way, this project is going to include those dams. By 1967, it had become obvious to everyone but Dominey and Carl Hayden that the Grand Canyon dams would have to go. Rescue for the Colorado Basin might never come without them, but the Central Arizona Project would never be built with them. The problem for Stuart Udall was how to sneak the amended legislation past Hayden and Dominey. Hayden might not be too much of a problem. He was old and senile and in the hospital half the time, and he was desperate to see the cap authorized before his death, which might come at any time. It was Dominey, bullheaded, willful, obsessed with defeating Brower, who somehow had to be handled. The opportunity came fairly soon. With the Bureau now helping to build dams all over the world, the commissioner had to make an annual global inspection of projects in progress. It was a condition imposed by the Agency for International Development, which was pumping billions of dollars into dam construction, and even as the Colorado River battle raged away, Dominey had to absent himself for a few weeks. In early 1967, The commissioner grabbed his hat and was gone. Almost as soon as his plane left the runway at Dulles Airport, Udall was telling his assistant secretary, Ken Holum, to take Bridge Canyon Dam out of the cap legislation and come up with an alternative before Dominey returned. The main objective was to find enough power to pump the water to central Arizona. The means of financing a rescue project would simply have to be put off. A Dominey representative would, of course, have to sit on the task force, and Udall had just the person in mind, Daniel Dreyfus. Publicly, Dreyfus could write a good rah-rah speech for Dominey about Marble Gorge and Bridge Canyon dams. Privately, he believed neither in them nor, for that matter, in the cap. He wasn't even sure he believed in the Bureau of Reclamation anymore. The hardest part for me was getting the regional commissioners to go along, Dreyfus would recall in his Senate office in 1981. Dominey had them all so scared that when I told them what we were up to, they wanted to crawl in a hole. Oh no, Floyd's got to be here. You know what Floyd would think of this? Floyd will shoot a brick. One regional director was so terrified, I had to fly out to Phoenix to put some fiber in his backbone. The solution itself was kind of clumsy, but it was simple. We decided to buy a share of the Navajo power plant in northern Arizona. For the first time, the Bureau was going to own something it always hated. A piece of a great big smoke-belching coal-fired power plant. It didn't solve a damn thing, except that it gave us the power to pump water to central Arizona. The fact is, we were licked. The conservationists and the press, and ultimately the public, licked the Bureau of Reclamation. And the last person in the world to admit it was Dominey. He wouldn't admit it, but I can't believe he didn't know what was coming. By the time he took off to go overseas, he was fighting a rearguard action, and he knew it. Maybe being out of the country was a way for him to save his honor. When he returned, I was the one who had to go see him with a copy of the agreement we'd worked out. I thought he was going to go through the roof, but Dominey always had a way of catching you off guard. His reaction was complete and total lack of interest. He already knew all about it. He just said, "I don't even want to hear about it," and told me to get the hell out of his office. He didn't even look up from what he was reading on his desk. Like the westbound wagons that had to jettison furniture, food, even water, in order to plow through the desert sands, the Central Arizona Project was finally light enough to move. The Colorado River Basin Project Act was signed into law by Lyndon Johnson on September 30, 1968, the most expensive single authorization in history. Besides the cap, it authorized Hooker Dam in the Gila Wilderness of New Mexico, the aqueduct from Lake Mead to Las Vegas, the Dixie Project in Utah, and the Uinta Unit of the Central Utah Project, the first piece of a water diversion scheme that promised to be nearly as grandiose as the cap. It also authorized the San Miguel, Dallas Creek, West Divide, Dolores, and Animas La Plata projects in Colorado, and it authorized the Lower Colorado Development Fund, still penniless, to build an augmentation project that hadn't yet been defined, let alone approved. Almost unnoticed alongside everything else, the bill made deliverance of Mexico's 1.5 million acre-feet of water, of tolerably sweet water, a national responsibility, whatever that meant. Loosely interpreted, it might mean a pipeline from Lake Superior to Mexicali. The five Colorado projects, which could easily add a cool $1 billion to the cost of everything else, were an object lesson in the workings of the congressional pork barrel. They were put into the bill at the insistence of Wayne Aspinall, the black-eyed former schoolteacher with a testy principal's disposition who had climbed from a little western Colorado town to become the chairman of the House Interior and Insular Affairs Committee. Aspinall distrusted urban expansionist California with all the recondite loathing of a small-town mind, and he didn't trust Arizona much more. The overallocated river ran right under the window of his expensive home on Aspinall Drive in Palisade, Colorado, and he figured that Colorado had better extract every drop of its rightful share, or California and Arizona would take it and never give it back. If the cap was to get past the chairman of the House Interior Committee, Colorado was going to be satisfied first. The problem was that by 1968, there wasn't a single irrigation project left on the west slope of the Rockies that was economically feasible. The best ones, or to put it more accurately, the least senseless ones, had already been authorized by the Colorado River Storage Project Act in 1956. If Colorado had a need for more water, and a place where a new project might actually make sense, it was on the eastern plains, where both the growing cities of the Front Range and the farms atop the Ogallala Aquifer were facing water famine 30 or 40 years down the road. One of the Bureau's most successful projects, Colorado Big Thompson, was already delivering Colorado River across the Continental Divide through a tunnel to the east slope. The power produced by the steep drop down the Front Range was enough to justify the expense of the tunnel, and the additional water diverted from the upper Colorado to tributaries of the Platte River was welcomed by everyone, from canoeists to whooping cranes to irrigators in Colorado and Nebraska. There was no reason why another such transbasin diversion project couldn't be built. No reason, that is, except Wayne Aspinall. The Eastern Plains were in someone else's district. During an interview in 1979, Felix Sparks, who selected the five projects at Aspinall's behest, conceded as much. 20 years ago, we already saw urbanization as inevitable, Sparks said, so I looked around for a place where we would keep a viable agricultural industry going. We didn't want to let cities and industry have the water. We picked those projects on the basis that it would be impossible, physically impossible, for Denver to get its hands on that water. It was an extraordinary admission. All that Sparks failed to mention was the fact that he was likely to benefit personally from new projects on the West Slope. Though a modestly paid public servant, Sparks was a fairly wealthy man, the result of some shrewd and highly secretive business investments across the Front Range. He was widely rumored to own a large interest in a food processing plant on the West Slope, a plant that could use a fresh supply of locally grown fruit nurtured on taxpayer-subsidized water. Of course, Felix Sparks, like a lot of Western farmers, didn't believe in such a thing as federally subsidized water. "This business of federal reclamation subsidizing irrigation water," he snorted, "is absolute, utter, unmitigated crap." Subsidy, however, was exactly what Aspinall and Sparks' five projects would require. Subsidy on a scale that made even the Bureau cringe. It fell to Dan Dreyfus, the Bureau's house magician, to invent enough benefits to make them pass muster. "Those projects were pure trash," said Dreyfus in an unusually candid interview in 1981, as he prepared to retire from public service. "I knew they were trash, and Dominey knew they were trash. The way they got into the bill was, Aspinall called up Udall one day and said, 'No Central Arizona project will ever get by me unless my five projects get authorized too.' When Udall passed the word on to us, we were appalled. The Office of Management and Budget had just bounced Animas La Plata. Now we had to give it back to them and make them reverse themselves. I had to fly all the way out to Denver and jerk around the benefit-cost numbers to make the thing look sound. As a last resort," Dreyfus continued with a grim smile, "Dominey and I went to see Aspinall and tried to talk him out of it. Dominey said, 'Look, Congressman, these projects won't work as irrigation projects. We can't afford to pump water from the reservoirs to the irrigable lands because we haven't got any surplus power in the river. And the alternative is to follow the land contours with canals that are going to be ungodly long and expensive. They'll cost so much, you might run into some real problems getting appropriations for these things.' What Dominey suggested was to build the dams and forget the rest. He said, 'What you really want is to capture your entitlement. The dams alone will do that. California will never see that water, and you'll cut the cost in half.'" "Dominey could be the most persuasive man I ever met," Dreyfus said. "But Aspinall wouldn't budge. He liked to think of himself as almighty principled, so he got huffy and said, 'The reclamation program knows no such thing as a project without beneficiaries. The answer is no.'" Those kinds of principles usually end up costing the taxpayers a lot of money, but in this case they may have cost Aspinall his projects. Why would California's and Arizona's congressional delegations, which outnumbered Colorado's 10-1, vote for appropriations for five projects which would mean surrendering water their own constituents were using? Since the projects made so little sense and were so expensive, the rest of Congress might follow their lead. Aspinall, however, had already succumbed to the twin delusions that affect so many committee chairmen, that he would be re-elected forever, and that he would live nearly that long. As long as he sat in his committee chair, he could deny California and Arizona whatever he pleased unless they voted in favor of his projects. It was a reasonable argument until he was bumped out of office 4 years later by a virtually unknown law professor named Alan Merson, a candidate who had campaigned heavily on the environmental principles that Aspinall often scorned. By 1987, only the Dolores project was close to being finished. It alone would end up costing $450 million, and the water promised to be so expensive that the farmers were anxiously trying to back out of their contracts. "We were dumb and greedy," said one junior Holland. "If they force us to buy the water now, it will bankrupt us." Meanwhile, 12 years and more than $2 billion after the passage of the Colorado River Basin Project Act, the Central Arizona project was nearly built, too. It would be a Dolores project on a far, far grander scale. A political mirage for three generations of Arizonans, the Central Arizona project is now a palpable mirage, as incongruous a spectacle as any on Earth. A man-made river flowing uphill in a place of almost no rain. To see it there in late 1985, just being filled, induces a kind of shock, like one's first sight of Mount McKinley or the Great Wall. But it is an illusion that works both ways. Up close, the Granite Reef Aqueduct seems almost too huge to be real. Where will all the water come from? From the air, however, the aqueduct and the river it diverts are reduced to insignificance by the landscape through which they flow, a desert that seems too vast for the most heroic pretensions of mankind. The water the aqueduct is capable of delivering is more than Cleveland, Detroit, and Chicago consume together. Pour it on Arizona, however, and would cover each acre with 0.02 of an inch. In the summer, when the temperature reaches 135 degrees at ground level, that much water would evaporate before you had a chance to blink. To build something so vast, an aqueduct that may stretch eventually to 333 miles, pumps that will lift the water 1,249 feet, four or five receiving reservoirs to hold the water when it arrives, at a cost that may ultimately reach $3 billion, perhaps even more, would seem to demand two prerequisites: that there be a demand for all the water, and that it be available in the first place. In Arizona, all of this has been an article of blind faith for more than half a century. Build a cap, and the aqueduct will be forever filled because of Arizona's compact entitlement. Fill the aqueduct, and the water will be put to immediate use. That is what every politician who ever aspired to sainthood in Arizona has said. But there are a number of reasons why this will not be the case, perhaps not remotely the case. If anything, the Central Arizona project may make the state's water crisis worse than ever before. When the Colorado River Basin Storage Act was bottled up in the House Interior Committee in the mid-1960s, it wasn't just the Sierra Club and the Grand Canyon dams that were responsible. The dams, it was feared, might drag the bill down to defeat on the floor of Congress, but it had to get out of committee first, and the bill's major hurdle there, a hurdle that seemed about 50 feet high, was California. California had five members on the committee and a powerful ally in John Saylor, the senior Republican committee member who was from Pennsylvania. Saylor was as antagonistic toward the Bureau of Reclamation as anyone in Congress. He especially loved to pick a fight with Floyd Dominey, and he was unalterably opposed to the cap. He was so valued in office by California that tens of thousands of dollars poured into his campaign coffers from that state to keep him there. What California demanded as the price for acquiescence was simple, devastatingly simple. Before Arizona received a drop of its entitlement, it wanted its full 4.4 million acre-foot entitlement guaranteed. As far as California was concerned, there would be no equitable sharing of shortages, no across-the-board cuts in times of drought. It wanted satisfaction no matter what. In fact, what it was really asking was a legislative reversal of the lawsuit it had lost in the Supreme Court. It was an outrageous demand from Arizona's point of view, and few believed that its congressional delegation would swallow it. But in the end, they did. "How do I explain it?" asked Sam Steiger, then a junior committee member from Arizona, repeating the question just asked of him. "I can't. Obviously, a deal was struck. I was too junior to be in on it. Mo Udall, Stewart's brother, and John Rhodes were the ones in a position to do it. Why did they do it? The only answer I can think of is that they didn't really believe the river was overallocated. That, or else they really believed we were going to get an augmentation project, even without Bridge Canyon Dam. The Bureau of Reclamation wasn't running around Capitol Hill crying, 'The river's overallocated! The river's overallocated!' I don't know what figures they were using, but we sure as hell weren't hearing the ones that came out a few years later. They made like there was plenty of water for everyone." And so, before a real fight even developed over California's imperious demand, the cap legislation became saddled with what is known as the California Guarantee, 4.4 million acre-feet or bust. Come drought, come calamity, California must be satisfied first. A few years later, the Bureau was finally forced to admit that its estimate of 17.5 million acre-feet a year was a convenient fiction, and amended it to around 15 million acre-feet. A few years after that, even the latter figure looked optimistic. Independent hydrologists were putting the Colorado's average flow at somewhere around 13 million acre-feet, perhaps a little more. Southern California was diverting its full 4.4 million acre-feet as it had for years. The upper basin had a diversion capability that had moved past 3.6 million acre-feet and was still building moderately. Evaporation varies from year to year, but averages close to 2 million acre-feet from all the reservoirs on the main stem and tributaries, and Mexico must get its 1.5 million acre-feet. Work these figures out, and the Colorado River is almost used up if its flow is as low as some say. If the higher estimates are used, there are 2 to 2.5 million acre-feet left. Now consider the projects that are authorized and in some cases nearly built or being built. The Central Utah Project, the Animas La Plata Project, the Dolores Project, the Fruitland Mesa Project, the West Divide Project, the Dallas Creek Project, San Miguel, Savory Pot Hook, Paonia, Florida, and the largest of them all, the CAP. Three or four of these could send the Colorado River into deficit. The rest will merely make that deficit hopeless. Everything has turned out exactly as could have been predicted 20 years ago. Everything, that is, except the rescue project that was supposed to have saved the basin states from a Sumerian fate. The prospects that an augmentation project would be built were already dim in the mid-1960s, before double-digit inflation, before double-digit interest rates, before environmentalism, before federal deficits four times larger than the federal budget was then. Meanwhile, Northern Californians have grown so jealous of their underused rivers that in a 1982 referendum they emphatically refused to release more water even to the desperate supplicants in the southern half of their own state. The Klamath River alone has nearly as much water in it as the Colorado and flows to the ocean almost entirely unused. And one could build a reservoir on it two-thirds the size of Lake Mead, but the odds of the Klamath River being rerouted to Southern California so the Colorado Basin states can have more water are about the same as the odds of being bitten by a rattlesnake while crossing the street in Washington, D.C. If that is unthinkable, then the odds that Oregon's rivers will be turned southward are even less so. As for the Columbia River diversion, it still has at least one champion. A Los Angeles supervisor named Kenneth Hahn, who introduces a resolution calling for it every year. But his resolution cannot even make it past the Board of Supervisors of one of the most water-starved cities in the world, and that, with luck, is about as far as it will get. The Colorado Basin, then, is a few years away from permanent drought, and it will have to make do with whatever nature decrees the flow shall be. If the shortages were to be shared equally among the basin states, then things might not be so bad for Arizona. But this will obviously not be the case. There is that fateful clause stipulating that California shall always receive its full 4.4 million acre-foot entitlement before Phoenix and Tucson receive a single drop. What began as an Olympian division of one river's waters emerged after 50 years of brokering, tinkering, and fine-tuning, according to the dictates of political reality, as an ultimate testament to the West's cardinal law, that water flows toward power and money. Despite one of the most spellbinding and expensive waterworks of all time, Arizonans from now until eternity will be forced to do what their Hohokam ancestors did, pray for rain. During wet cycles, when Lake Mead and Lake Powell are sending water down the spillways as they were in 1983, the Granite Reef Aqueduct may be delivering something close to peak yield. During drought cycles, the aqueduct may run half empty, if that, and the odds are extremely high that it will run progressively more empty as the years go by. It would be foolish, at this stage, to surmise that all or even most of the Upper Basin projects are going to be built, but a few of them are likely to be, and each one will cut into the cap supply. The Colorado River, to which Arizona decided to marry its future hopes, will prove no more trustworthy than a capricious mistress, delivering 1 million acre-feet 1 year, 400,000 the next. And this, in turn, raises a bizarre possibility, as unthinkable to modern Arizona as it was to the planners of the cap. The people of Arizona may not even want the modest amount of precious water this $3 billion project is able to deliver. In early 1980, Phoenix experienced a series of damaging winter floods. The Salt River goes through the center of town and is usually an utterly dry bed of pebbles and rocks. Therefore, city streets are laid right across the river, as if it had long since gone extinct. In 1980, however, it rolled cars like boulders, cars whose owners were so used to driving through the riverbed that, despite repeated warnings on the radio, they didn't bother to detour and cross on a bridge as the waters began to rise. Even if they had, it wouldn't have done them much good. Only two of Phoenix's bridges were designed to withstand a flood flow greater than 25,000 cubic feet per second. In February of 1980, the Salt River peaked at 180,000 cubic feet per second. Phoenix owes its existence to this ephemeral desert river, but even so, it doesn't seem to hold the salt in high esteem. On both banks, the floodplain is encroached on by industrial parks, trailer parks, RV parks, but no real parks. The flood channel itself has been developed to a degree, playing host to establishments which are, by nature, transient, topless bottomless joints, chop shops, cockfighting emporia. Paris built its great cathedral by its river, Florence its palaces of art. Phoenix seems to have decided that its river is the proper place to relegate its sin. When the Bureau of Reclamation performed a cost-benefit analysis for the Orem Dam, once a central feature of the Central Arizona Project, it included as a benefit the flood protection the dam would offer to the cockfighting and striptease establishments downstream. That particular dam, a $400 million structure intended to store Colorado River water shipped over in the Granite Reef Aqueduct and to hold back the occasional flood surge, was one of the main topics of conversation in 1980. On February 27th, just after the biggest flood hit, the Arizona Republic ran a huge editorial that read, "Are you fed up sitting in traffic, creeping to work, because floods have taken out all but two of the major bridges crossing the Salt River? Are you fed up with reading stories about a new study and more hearings into whether construction of Orem Dam would interrupt the nesting habits of bald eagles? Of this community playing second fiddle to high and dry special pleaders who shed tears over nesting eagles but can't find compassion for the thousands of families who endure hardship, fear, and ruin as floodwaters rampage through the valley?" "I'm mad," continued the editorial, which was signed by the Republic's editor-in-chief, Patrick Murphy. "I'm mad as hell that high and dry Washington bureaucrats have been dilly-dallying for at least 10 years over approval of Orem Dam. Now, damn it, give us our dam." The special pleaders Murphy referred to numbered among them the Yavapai Indians, whose remnant population of 300 or so lives on a reservation near the confluence of the Salt and Verde Rivers, and who would lose their homes to the reservoir. The Yavapai, who appear to be some of the most peaceful, sweet-natured souls on earth, many of them are old and still weave baskets for a living, had won a lot of well-placed sympathy, which was apparently what Murphy was complaining about. Cecil Andrus, then the outgoing Secretary of the Interior, and someone who spent a good part of his term trying to stop the Bureau from carrying out its plans, vowed that the tribe would be relocated over his dead body, and one local attorney who was preparing to fight Orem Dam on their behalf was Stuart Udall, the man who, as much as anyone, had made the cap in Orem Dam possible. In later years, Udall, unlike the Bureau, was to rue much of what he said and did in the 1960s. He even spoke at a testimonial dinner in 1982, celebrating the 70th birthday of his old nemesis, David Brower. The dam was in the news so often that one could almost imagine the dancers in the bars debating the pros and cons between acts. What was most striking about the debate, however, was that practically no one seemed to be asking the more fundamental question about Orem Dam. As a $400 million flood control structure, it made little economic sense. It would be much cheaper to move the relatively few threatened structures and reinforce the bridges. Only if it received and stored a substantial amount of Colorado River water, which implied not only a decent flow in the river, but a demand for the water and an ability to pay for it, did Orem Dam make any sense. Would the water arrive, and arrive predictably and often enough, and be economical enough, so that anyone would want to buy it? In 1980, one of the few people in the state who seemed to be asking this question was William Martin, an economist at the University of Arizona at Tucson. For having done so, and answering negatively, Martin had been accused in local newspapers of being a paid agent of California, where he was born. The dean of his department denied him merit raises for 8 years, and even led a campaign to discredit his academic qualifications, though he wouldn't go quite so far as to try to have him fired outright. Large and bearded, inclined toward jeans, cowboy hats, and western shirts, Martin looks as if he would feel more at home in the cockpit of a Peterbilt than at a professor's desk, even if his writings are nationally known. His first notoriety came in 1973, when he and a colleague, Robert Young, who was so wounded by the hounding he got that he opted to leave the state, published a book called Water Supplies and Economic Growth in an Arid Environment, an innocuous-sounding little tract which, in Arizona, was almost as revolutionary as Das Kapital. They first asked, as a matter of speculation, what might happen if the Central Arizona Project was not built. The underground aquifers, Young and Martin reckoned, would undoubtedly be depleted as the farmers continued to pump them out. In the 1960s, the rate of overdraft, use over replenishment, climbed as high as 4 million acre-feet per year. As pumping costs rose due to the dropping water table, some farmers would begin to go out of business. But there was still enough water so that the decline would be very slow. Arizona's farm income, by Young and Martin's calculations, would be reduced by about 0.1% per year. The reason the decline in income would be so modest was self-evident. As pumped water got more expensive, the farmers would conserve it better and switch to higher-value crops, and they would do more with less. The way to see if the Central Arizona Project was worth building, then, was to see if each acre-foot of water it brought in would be cheaper than the value in lost farm income of each disappearing acre-foot from the aquifers. Martin and Young figured that every acre-foot that was being mined was causing a loss of $5.35 in farm income, a conservative estimate as far as they were concerned. Could the cap deliver water cheaper than that? By the Bureau's own calculations, cap water would cost at least $10 per acre-foot, without even figuring the cost of distributing it. As a result, the farmers would make more money if they continued pumping groundwater than if they bought water from the cap. In fact, if the price of distribution systems, which the farmers would presumably have to build themselves, was as high as it promised to be, buying cap water might be a ticket into bankruptcy. Twice since then, Martin has repeated the analysis, and his results confirm his earlier conclusions, only far more emphatically. By 1977, the projected canal-side price of cap water had reached $16.67 per acre-foot. Add the cost of a distribution network and farmers growing any kind of low-value crops, alfalfa, small grains, perhaps even the state's main crop, cotton, could not afford it. In 1980, he and another colleague from the University of Arizona, Helen Ingram, did a detailed study, region by region, of the likely cost of distribution systems, and were amazed by what they found out. In one irrigation district, Maricopa Stansfield, the price of the distribution system, hundreds of miles of canals and laterals, headgates and people to operate them, would likely come to $160 million, leaving each farmer a bill of $100 per acre-foot of water per year just for distribution. The Bureau's canal site estimate for cap water had, by then, risen to around $30 per acre-foot per year. The price of pumped groundwater was nearly $100 less per acre-foot at Maricopa Stansfield, around $39. It was an extreme case, but Ingram and Martin couldn't find a single irrigation district where cap water promised to be cheaper than groundwater. In most of them, it would cost half again or twice as much, sometimes more. One of the main arguments the farmers had always made for the cap was that they couldn't all switch to high-value crops as the groundwater table went lower and pumping costs became intolerable. The American consumer, they said, could only eat so many lemons and oranges. But if Martin's figures were right, farmers who signed contracts to buy cap water might not even be able to raise oranges on it. In 1980, about the only crop you could raise with water that cost $130 per acre-foot was marijuana. But that was the good news. The bad news was that during periods of drought, with California guaranteed its full entitlement before Arizona received a drop, this incredibly expensive water might often not arrive. The Bureau's own projections showed firm cap water dwindling from 1.6 million acre-feet at the beginning to 300,000 acre-feet or less in 50 years. Only during wet years, or if the upper basin projects are never built, will there be more. To think of the Central Arizona project as salvation, then, is not just to stretch things a bit. For those groundwater-dependent farmers who will have to build distribution systems at least, and there are a lot of them, the Central Arizona project could spell economic ruin. Did Arizona's farmers realize any of this? One of William Martin and Helen Ingram's graduate students, Nancy Laney, traveled around the state to find out. To her astonishment, most of the farmers didn't. One of the farms Laney visited was the Farmers Investment Corporation, a huge pecan-growing operation south of Tucson that is about as far from the diversion point on the Colorado River as one can be. Why pecans, which are native to the Mississippi Delta, should be grown on subsidized water in a desert state is another matter entirely. If it arrives, cap water will have surmounted a lift of well over 1,000 feet, and traveled more than 300 miles to get there. Meanwhile, there is still plenty of water immediately under the farm, less than 200 feet down. Despite the huge subsidies written into the cap, as with any reclamation project, the farmers are excused from paying interest costs, the groundwater is certain to be much cheaper, at least until the aquifer drops several hundred more feet. The worst area-wide decline in Arizona's water table has been around 200 feet, and that took decades to happen. But the farm manager at Farmers Investment expressed to Laney his unalterable belief that cap water will be cheaper than pumping. Water is essential, he said with religious conviction, adding that he would back any plan where more water would be available. He had no idea what cap water would cost them, but he planned to sign contracts to buy it anyway. His state of knowledge and level of blind faith were not unusual. One farmer thought that the water was going to arrive by gravity instead of being pumped many hundreds of feet uphill. One believed that there was still enough surplus water in the Colorado River to turn the entire Grand Canyon into a reservoir, something he devoutly wished. Only two of the farmers Laney interviewed seemed to have a sense of things as they really were. One realized that Arizona's Colorado River water was jeopardized and thought it was high time we took Canada's surplus water to replenish it. The other said that even if it turned out he couldn't afford cap water, he was going to sign a contract to buy it anyway, because contracts are made to be broken. Contracts are made to be broken. There, in a simple phrase, was perhaps the worst legacy of the Bureau of Reclamation's 80 years as the indulgent godfather of the arid West. The irrigation farmers not only had come to expect heavily subsidized water as a kind of right, allowing them to pretend that the region's preeminent natural fact, a drastic scarcity of that substance, was an illusion. They now believed that if it turned out they couldn't afford the water, the Bureau, which is to say, the nation's taxpayers, would practically give it away. These farmers were about the most conservative faction in what may be the most politically conservative of all the 50 states. They regularly sent to Congress politicians eager to demolish the social edifice built by the New Deal, to abolish welfare, school lunch programs, aid to the handicapped, funding for the arts, even to sell off some of the national parks and public lands. But their constituents had become the ultimate example of what they decried, so coddled by the government that they lived in the cocoon-like world of a child. They remained oblivious to what their cap water would cost them, but were certain it would be offered to them at a price they could afford. The farmers had become the very embodiment of the costly, irrational welfare state they loathed, and they had absolutely no idea. In 1984, Congress began to demonstrate why the farmers might not be so foolish after all. Early that year, it voted to lend them $200 million to help build distribution systems, an interest-free loan, as one might have expected, but the sum was only about half of what they would need, and there was a lot of resistance to lending them the rest. But they still weren't out of the woods. For one thing, the Indian water rights issue was still substantially unresolved. There was a good chance that the white farmers would have to lease water from the Indians, who could well end up with most of the water in the cap. The Ak Chin and the Papago tribes had recently settled with the Interior Department for 300,000 acre feet, about the consumption of Phoenix. The Papago's tribes' water will come directly out of the Tucson Aqueduct, water which the farmers, most of whom had conveniently ignored the Indian water rights question, had always expected to get. More and more, the cap was metamorphosing from an agricultural rescue project into an expensive atonement for travesties visited on the Indians, and, perhaps, into a municipal water supply project for Phoenix and Tucson, if they feel they can afford it. The cities in Arizona are going to get hit even worse than the farmers, Bill Martin told an interviewer in 1984. The farmers at least get the interest-free subsidy, which is worth a fortune to them. They also get interest-free loans on things like the distribution systems. Their cities get none of that. They pay full fare. Here in Tucson, we're already drawing groundwater out of neighboring basins because we've depleted ours, and we pay around $430 per household, which seems like a lot. But most of that, I'd say around $400, is to pay off the water mains, the infrastructure, the bureaucracy. It's a distribution cost. It only costs us $30 or a little more to pump the water. But to pump cap water all the way from the Colorado River to Tucson is going to cost at least $250 per acre foot. That's what the water is worth when you get rid of all the interest subsidies and so forth. Add $250 to $400, the distribution cost, and people are going to be paying $650 for water.
There are families around here who only earn 10 or 15 times that much in a year.
So what's obviously going to happen is people are going to conserve and use a lot less water, and there will be less and less of a need for the cap. It's already happening, Martin continued. We've all gotten water conscious, even if we weren't before. Tucson uses a third less water than Phoenix, because up there they still get cheap water from the Salt River Project. Once Phoenix starts paying $600 a year, though, they're going to conserve just like we are.
But if the farmers can't afford the water, and the cities can't afford the water, then who is going to buy it and justify the whole expense?
Damned if I know, was Martin's response.
If it seems implausible that Arizona's farmers will buy here today, gone tomorrow water that costs three times what farm economics suggests they can pay, if it seems implausible that cities will want to waste millions of dollars a year buying turbid, alkaline water from the Colorado River when they can pump cheaper, fresher groundwater instead, if all of this seems unlikely, What is even less likely is that Arizona and the Bureau of Reclamation will permit a giant concrete aqueduct to sit empty in the desert, a ruin before its time. For the aqueduct to remain full as long as it can, however,